You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Aloud. My name is Miranda King, and I'm the program producer here at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Through fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programs, the Library Foundation strengthens and promotes greater awareness of the Los Angeles Public Library and its essential services. I'm very excited about the program you're all about to see here tonight, but before I welcome our guests, I'd like to talk for a moment about one of the programs the Library Foundation supports, Summer with the Library, part of the Reading Challenges program at Los Angeles Public Library. Reading Challenges aim to motivate Angelenos to participate in year-round reading and engaging activities and inspire literacy and learning through themed programming. The next challenge goes until August 7th, and you can register online now from the library's website. Programs are completely virtual this year, and there are prizes for all sorts of participation. Please visit lapl.org/events for more information. In Finding the Mother Tree, Suzanne Simard shows us that forests are actually social cooperative creatures connected through underground networks. The trees perceive and recognize neighbors, compete and cooperate, learn and adapt their behaviors, remember the past, and have agency about the future. The forest provides a beautiful model of resiliency, adaptability, and recovery, one that can inspire all of us after a year spent apart. The trees take care of each other, and so must we in order to thrive. I'm honored to introduce our two panelists for tonight. Suzanne Simard was born in the mountains of British Columbia and was educated at the University of British Columbia and Oregon State University. She's a professor of forest ecology in the University of British Columbia's Faculty of Forestry. She's a pioneer on the frontier of plant communication and intelligence, and an incredible writer who conveys complex technical ideas in a way that is dazzling and profound. Her work has influenced filmmakers like James Cameron and writers like Richard Powers, and her TED Talks have been viewed by more than 10 million people worldwide. Her newest book is Finding the Mother Tree, Discovering the Wisdom of the Forest. Gia Tolentino is one of the sharpest cultural critics and essayists writing today. She is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of the New York Times bestselling essay collection, Trick Mirror. Formerly, she was deputy editor at Jezebel and a contributing editor at The Hairpin. Her work has also appeared in The New York Times Magazine and Pitchfork, among other places. She lives in Brooklyn. Please join me in welcoming Suzanne Simard and Gia Tolentino.
Hi.
Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Miranda. Oh, Suzanne, I think you're muted. Yes.
Thank you, Miranda.
A classic
Hi,
problem.
Gia. Yes.
And hello to everyone who is here, you know, on the month 15 of Zoom events. It means so much to be with all of you. I wish it was in person, but it is a pleasure to be transported to your kitchens and living rooms and bedrooms tonight. And thank you to the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and to Aloud for making this happen. We're gonna talk for about 35, 40 minutes and then take questions. So please put questions in the chat. It's an enormous, enormous honor to be here tonight in conversation with Suzanne Simard, who's a legend. A person whose work has changed the natural world, changed forestry practices, changed the way we understand what's around us, and whose work persistently resets me and radicalizes me and challenges me in the way that it leads me towards a different cosmology, different set of ethics, one that, you know, that's based on timescales and value propositions that are not egocentric, that are not centered on our lives or our existences, but that dwarf us entirely, that predate us by millennia and will outlast us by as much. And it's, you know, the sort of psychedelic smallness that I crave, that I found myself craving more than ever over the past year, and that opens up this sort of new path to wonder and gratitude and fumbling towards this knowledge of how to live.
Thank you, Gia. That was a really great introduction. I feel like I'm fumbling all the time too. So
that's really good to know. We'll get to all the things in your beautiful memoir that, you know, reassured me. And anyway, but I guess, you know, I want to start by asking, what have we only begun to understand is true about the forest? Let's start with that simple question.
Wow, that's such a great question. And I think if I look back to when I started this work and what we understood then, you know, that the forest is made of trees that are there to compete, you know, based on, you know, basically how we understood evolution, that we learned from Darwin, that, you know, that competition is what drives speciation. And then we applied those ideas to ecology, you know, and ecology is really about the relationships between species. And this idea that competition reigns supreme and structures forests and plant communities, you know, it had profound impacts on how we've treated our natural environment. You know, I mean, not that Darwin was wrong, but he was incomplete. And I think he knew he was incomplete. He knew that collaboration worked as strongly and deeply as competition, and he wrote about it, but it didn't make it into sort of our modern thinking. And so it's only been sort of like rediscovering, you know, later, Lynn Margulis sort of uncovering what Darwin was trying to say in the lines between his writing. And then she was trying to, you know, get us to understand that that evolution really was about co-evolution, about symbiosis. And that we should treat our ecosystems more fully, more holistically, as though we understood this full suite of relationships between creatures. And yeah, and so if I think back to when I started this, my thinking is also completely turned around and tried to, and I've embraced this more holistic understanding of how communities function, how they're structured, you know, how forests are structured, how any plant community or any animal community for that matter includes this multifarious, multitudinous, complex, sophisticated way of creatures relating to one another.
Yeah, and you write, you know, you're sort of essentially you're reframing the natural, in reframing the natural logic of a forest from competition to cooperation and sort of thriving through cooperation. It reframes the overarching value proposition from short-term profit to long-term well-being, right? Like there's, you know, you write about, there was this idea, you know, when you were early in your forestry career that sort of trees were better off getting rid of anything that might compete with them for air, for sunlight, you know, and then there's this realization that trees, like people, don't actually like to live in chemically managed isolation, right? And are, yeah, as we've all realized, and yeah, are, you know, healthier when there's give and take, when they have the opportunity to give of themselves and then receive. And, you know, you write about like certain practices might up the yield for 1 year, you know, like heavily pesticided, whatever might up the yield for 1 year, but it eventually would manifest consequences for the soil, for the resilience of the crops. I think about this one part of your memoir where you write about, you know, these seedlings that are, I'm going to, you know, put this all wrong because I...
No, it's okay. It's
beautiful. Are sort of grown in greenhouses in these little tubes and they're so strong, they're ready to be planted. Like they don't... they're too strong and they don't learn that they need to sort of absorb nutrients elsewhere. And this becomes sort of damaging for their longer life. And they're, you know, they're all sort of metaphorical resonances with this. But, you know, there's obviously this sort of exact parallel with the most important political and economic argument being made currently about humans and about how we live, you know. And I, early in the pandemic, I wrote about, you know, the like mutual aid networks becoming sort of a mainstream practice in the pandemic, and this sort of idea of Peter Kropotkin's that, you know, as you said, cooperation was as intrinsic to sort of the survival of communities writ large. And, you know, the time is ripe for this idea, you know, to put it mildly, it's sort of life and death at the moment, you know, the degree to which we embrace these one value proposition over the one that has driven much of our world for the last, you know, 300 years. And, you know, you write about, it was difficult making the argument against sort of competition only and sort of short-term yield only in the 80s and the 90s, but now, you know, I wonder if you've seen what you've seen over the past year and a half in terms of the way people have related to your work and to your memoir. You know, I think there has been this intense, obvious hunger for, you know, not just like a reconnection to nature, but for a fundamentally different worldview, right? I mean, kinship and protection rather than exploitation. And I'm wondering if you felt that, and what has it felt like to finally, you know, if you felt that the world is really ready for these ideas.
No, you're absolutely right, Gia. I mean, you know, we've been struggling, I think, as a society with these sort of very narrow ways of of behaving and thinking of the world, that, you know, that that dominance is good, that, you know, capitalism is, you know, is perfect and it's not, that it'll lead to wealth of all, but it doesn't, right? It's got all of these, there's all of these ways to cheat the system or to loopholes, that so that capitalism doesn't really exist as itself. It's corrupted. And I think that, you know, I think that we see that. We see that in our economics. We see that in our society. We see that in poverty. You know, we see that in oppression of different groups. We, you know, it's too easy for the dominant to really become more and more dominant. And the inequality and wealth is a perfect example. It's really like the litmus test of how well this capitalistic model is really working. And in ecology, the litmus test is, you know, we can see all kinds of results of this sort of narrow thinking that competition is everything and dominance is everything, in, you know, in the big indicators. So the big indicators being like global change. Right. If the planet was healthy and in balance, we wouldn't see greenhouse gases rising and rising and rising. We wouldn't see species extinctions exploding, you know, in real time right in front of us. And I think that, you know, and even though, you know, we in our everyday lives, it's not that we want any of this. Most of us are just not even aware that, you know, as we're living our lives, that all around us, our lives are actually being managed. Our food is being managed. Our forests are being managed, and not with faulty theories. And it's profound. It's profoundly important. So this idea that competition reigns supreme in forests, it governs everything that we do. For example, how we cut forests. You know, clear cutting is about opening up the space to let all that light in, so that we can grow trees that are bigger and faster than the past, you know, and then we apply herbicides to get rid of the plants we don't want, because we want, you know, them not to be competing with these conifers or whatever the plantation that we're trying to grow. And then we space them, and then we prune them, and then we do all these cultivation practices with the idea that, you know, we can create these big trees that dominate. And yet, you know, what we've missed here is half the picture, which is that they depend on their neighbors, right? They depend on their kinship. They depend on good relationships with other trees and other plants and the soils and fungi and bacteria, and goodness knows, even people. And so once we figure this out, once we see the fuller picture, that there's collaboration, there's competition, yes, there's parasitisms, there's all kinds of other benefits in the forest that trees rely on, that they're part of that. Once we see the fuller picture and then change our management practices, we can create a healthier forests, healthy agriculture systems, healthier meadows and prairies. And this will all have immediate feedbacks to climate, right? We'll start mitigating climate change. We'll start saving species. We'll start creating more equal. I think if it transcends and cuts across to our society, human societies, it will change that too. So it is really important that we get a grip on this.
Yeah, well, and you know, you write about, and I think this is something, like I was just watching some TV show on my laptop last night, and you know, I saw the Charmin commercial that's like, we plant a tree for everyone we cut down. And you know, I think now there's sort of this dawning realization that actually there is a massive difference between a single tree planted in one of these orderly plantations and the amount of sort of carbon capture that these old trees. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's like, oh, we'll get carbon offsets, we'll plant another tree, but actually, you know, it's not equal.
Yeah, it's not equal at all. And that's a really important point you bring up because I think people want to know what to do the right thing, right? How do I invest to promote the right practices that will mitigate these negative effects that we're seeing in our ecosystem? So you're right, like old forests, they store tons and tons of carbon. An old growth forest, it stores mega tons of carbon. The redwood forests are some of the biggest carbon sinks in the world. The West Coast forests, all the way from Alaska down to California, these are huge carbon storehouses. The Amazon, the boreal forest, the taiga of Russia, all these places are crucial. And yet here we are cutting them down as fast as we possibly can. Yeah. And each time we cut down those forests, you know, half the carbon is above ground, what we see, half of it is below ground. And as soon as we cut the above ground part and take away those big stems, about 65% of it just evaporates it into the air immediately. So that's from turning these big old trees into toilet paper and paper that basically disappear within the year. And then some turn into longer term products, but really there's nothing like storing it in a tree. And these old trees continue to accrue carbon as they get older and older and older, which has also, you know, been misconstrued in the media, or sorry, even in literature, I guess, but also in, you know, how people promote, you know, their own interests, that old forests are decadent. They're not at all. They continue to accrue or sequester carbon more and more compared to a plantation where, yeah, as soon as you cut it, you know, most of the carbon has gone into the atmosphere. 65% is a good estimate. Below ground, you know, that forest floor, the mineral soil underneath, that's where half the other carbon is in the roots, and that starts to decompose. And so some of that we also lose as well. And the longer we leave it fallow, or, you know, plant these little seedlings, you know, they can't stop the carbon from mineralizing and escaping into the atmosphere. They've got to be returned as quickly as possible to old forests. And that takes decades and decades, if not hundreds of years. Yes. So right now it's absolutely crucial, because climate is changing so quickly, that we keep these old forests in place, protect them, reforest the places that we've deforested. And if we have to cut, to focus it on places that have already been cut and the losses have already been realized.
Yeah, and you, right, you mentioned there is sort of this vague idea that sort of valuing these old trees is this sort of emotional or aesthetic or kind of proposition, when in fact, you know, the argument is really one, or, you know, there are many arguments, but a primary one is survival of human life or life in general.
Yeah.
But, and you know, and you're right, like there are ways to, you know, to harvest trees sustainably. And I reading your memoir, I was thinking, like, I found myself gravitating, like the farmer James Rebanks, his new book is sort of about pastoral song, is about rejecting conventional, the sort of American style, high yield farming for crops. And I recently read The One Straw Revolution by Masanobu Fukuoka, this Japanese farmer who became known in the 70s for a method of farming he called do nothing farming. You know, touched his fields as little as possible, applied no pesticides, mm-hmm. you know, used natural manure, like ended up with yields that were as good as, you know, mm-hmm. American style farming, and soil that was not blasted into this inert state. And I was reading the book, and, you know, there's this comic quality in that book where it's this sort of profound humility where he's constantly reminding the reader that we should be asking what we cannot do as much, if not more, than we ask what we can do. Mm-hmm. And there's this funny point where he sort of tells people to be suspicious of the world of the intellect, because the further you pursue any discipline, the more you'll be reminded that we actually know nothing. And then science always ultimately reminds us of how small human knowledge is. And I am interested in that last point, as it might relate in some way to your own research journey, because you write in your memoir that this, you know, decades of meticulous scientific experimentation, you know, like watching, you know, tracing carbon through roots and, you know, plant transfers one to another, and it ends up leading you back to the oldest wisdom that exists, to this indigenous idea that trees communicate, that they share knowledge, that mother trees take care of their young, right? There's mm-hmm. this way in which you go on this vast sort of official scientific journey, and then you circle right back, but you know what I mean. And I wonder, yeah. mm-hmm. And I wonder, like, what that process was like, sort of seeing these old ideas ratified mm-hmm. in the data.
You know, yeah, I mean, what a process. It was full of joy, full of frustration, full of anxiety, you know, as I learned more and more, for example, about climate change and what are, you know, I guess when I was in about 30, that's when, and I was at Oregon State University, and I saw the first presentation I'd ever seen, and it was by the Environmental Protection Agency, and they put these graphs up on the screen showing how CO2 levels were going up and how temperature was correlated with this, and I'm just like, oh my god, you know, because I was thinking as I was doing my research, you know, slowly, methodically, you know, I knew that from growing up in the forest, that the forest was a connected place. And I did this research carefully, methodically, to try to get the industry, which had gone from, you know, what my grandparents did, who were horse loggers doing selective, careful logging, to this wholesale take everything approach. And I was trying to, you know, slowly take my time to show, you know, there's another way here. If we look more fully at these ecosystems, we can do this a better job. And then the climate change thing hit me and I go, oh my God, we don't have time to do, you know, to carefully trace every little thing and figure it all out. I've got to get out there now and say, we know enough. We know enough to do things differently. And you know, these other authors that you cite, they're on the right track, right? Like, forest ecosystems, we've evolved to heal, we've evolved to be healthy, we've evolved to fill in the space and be productive. But when we rip it apart with pesticides and clear cutting and machines and tilling, like deep plowing, that kind of thing, it does rip these ecosystems apart. And we don't have time for that now, right? We have to make these changes now. And so that means regenerative farming, regenerative forestry, where you, you know, it doesn't mean that people can't be involved. Definitely we play an important role, and we have always played an important role ever since we've been on this planet. We've been interacting with forests and ecosystems, but there are good ways to do it. And then there are destructive ways to do it. And these industrial ways of, you know, of high energy input systems, where you apply pesticides and you apply, you know, fossil fuels to run the machinery, and you take away without reciprocating, right, without giving back, then that ecosystem will slowly chunk down until it collapses. And so we're seeing that, right? We're seeing that in our ecosystems. And if, you know, we need to, you know, to, you're right, step back, but also not completely step away, because now we've gotten to this point with climate change that the velocity of climate change is so rapid. Trees can't adapt that fast. And they can't migrate that fast, you know, to keep up with the warming. So we have to help them. We have to use all of our ingenuity on how to move genotypes, on how to assist the migration of plants and trees so that they can withstand these stresses. And we need to do this because, you know, our lives depend on keeping carbon in the ground, keeping forests intact so they can continue to photosynthesize, so they can continue to capture light energy and turn it into chemical energy to drive all the big biogeochemical cycles. We need them to do that. If we lose that, we've lost ourselves. So it is imperative.
And you're sort of, so you're talking about basically applying these old values, but to new circumstances that require,
yes,
it's like that we, if the climate is changing so quickly, the, you know, these like indigenous practice will have to be updated to fit. And, you know, we're saying this at a time when the entire West Coast of, you know, America is in this heat wave, you know, it's,
yeah,
127 degrees in California. I mean, I wanted to ask you if you could,
that's so hot.
I know, it's 107 in Oregon. I mean, it's like, you thinking about like even people working in farms outside, it's wild. Yeah. But I wanted you to, if you wouldn't mind, explain the mother tree concept.
And
because I already saw a couple questions about this in the chat, you know, just give us a little, for people who might not know, people who might not have, everyone read the Overstory, read the Times Mag article that was about Suzanne last year and read this memoir. But yeah, if you could just explain how you found that trees communicate, what are they communicating? What substances, through what substances are they sending signals, and what is a mother tree?
Yeah, this is the crux of it. So the mother tree is just really the biggest tree in the forest. And it's also the oldest tree, but if you have a forest that's all the same age, it's really just the biggest trees. So what makes them so special? Well, they have huge crowns, right? They have a huge leaf area, and that leaf area is where photosynthesis happens. And so that energy then transmits in and builds tissues in the trees, but a lot of it, you know, about a third of it, at least in some ecosystems, it's 80% of it goes into the root system. And then it's transmitted into these fungi called mycorrhizas. And a mycorrhiza literally is a fungus root. It's a relationship between a fungus and a root where the tree provides this photosynthate, this energy to the fungus. The fungus grows mycelium, the fungal hyphae, through the soil. And the mycelium picks up nutrients and water and brings it back to the tree in an exchange. So some of these fungi, actually all of the fungi, can link trees together. So some of the fungi will link trees of the same species. Some will link trees of different species. There are literally thousands of these mycorrhizal fungal species in the world. And so we actually sought out to make a map of what this network looked like in the Douglas fir forests of British Columbia, which were, you know, multi-age forests with some trees that were upwards of 300 years old, and the smallest were just little seedlings, and all ages in between. And we mapped what one of the two of the fungal species looked like below ground, linking these trees together. And we found that every tree was linked to every other tree, but the biggest, oldest trees were the most highly connected. So that's because they had more roots, right? And more root tips and more mycorrhizas, and they had more energy flowing into their root systems. And so then, you know, okay, so in graph theory, when you're describing these kind of networks, they come out as biological neural networks. That's the pattern. And biological neural networks have hubs and links. So the hubs are the trees and the links are the fungi in this example. And the biggest hubs, all complex networks have big ones, a few big ones, and a lot of little ones. And so these big ones, I wanted to know what was their role in the ecosystem. And so it turns out that these old trees, as they're transmitting energy to the soil and to their neighbors, they're especially subsidizing the carbon energy or carbon economy of the little seedlings growing up in the understory. And these little seedlings are growing in the shade. They've got few, they don't have very many needles. They can't really support themselves at first. So they tap into this network. They get some water, they get some carbon and nitrogen from the old trees, and they grow and survive and eventually become trees themselves. And you know, it turns out that these old trees can even favor the seedlings that are from their own cones, right? They're kin. And so that led us to calling them mother trees. You know, it's a colloquial name, but it aptly describes the role of these big old trees in forests. So they really are the nucleus of the forest. And not only do they connect everything and facilitate regeneration, they are also where most of the carbon is stored. And they're homes for so many species. They're like big scaffoldings for biodiversity themselves.
It's, you write in your memoir, you know, this memoir was somehow, it was more personal. I mean, it's a memoir, but it was still, you know, you write really movingly about your own experience as a mother in early motherhood, which was especially, I had a pandemic baby. And I think maybe that was one of the reasons that I started paying more attention to these cycles of sort of like rebirth and fallowness and, you know, in the natural world. And, you know, you write, you know, there's this period of really intense enmeshment with your family life and your professional life, where you're sort of nursing your baby right about when you're about to give a presentation, you lactate through your shirt on stage, right? You're working till 2 a.m. after putting your kids to bed every night, you're commuting 9 hours each way on the weekends. And, you know, and then you're writing at the same time about, you know, there's a sense that you're feeling your own capacity grow beyond what you might have thought possible or preferable. And I thought about this passage where you talk about coring a mother tree and thinking, you know, you would see char marks every 20 years or so, you know, from when people would do controlled fires. And it's just, you know, it's a sort of a story of expansion and challenge and resilience and, you know, your own and the natural world. You also write, you know, you mentioned earlier that our bodies were made to heal. Mm-hmm. And you write in the book about being diagnosed with breast cancer, having a double mastectomy. And you write that the grueling experience of chemo showed you that the body was made to heal and gave you some sort of insight into the way forests were too. And, you know, this is like this amazing reminder that things are recuperable, that it's worth trying to understand what sustains and heals, you know, a body and ecosystem. But as you also write, there are some things that a body at the same time, there are some things that a body can't recover from. There are, with your daughter in the forest when she's much older and you're watching her realize that, you know, there are some things that maybe a mother tree can't recover from. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question was, like, how did you fight off the fear of that, of the point of no return, either in your journey with breast cancer or about the natural world and the things we've done to it, you know, as you said, often by accident, often above our heads, often inadvertently, but the things that we have done, you know, you think there's a moment where you, after your diagnosis, where you think like, I should never have pursued this stressful university job. I should never have round up in experiments, worked with radioactive carbon, stressed about the end of my marriage, you know, like how did you move between the frame of, you know, we're made to heal, and also there are things too significant to heal from sometimes?
Yeah. Wow, Gia, you should write a book. You're brilliant. Those are brilliant thoughts. You probably already have written a book. We go through this life journey, right? We grow, we learn, and you know, for me, and I think I'm not atypical, but you know, you're born, you have this wonderful life, but there's this specter of death. You know, we're afraid of death. I think most people probably wonder, what's death like? You know, is it really awful? Am I? And for me, it was more like, I just want to live and I don't want to die. And but I had this fear. And then I got this deadly disease. And I had to come to grips with it, right? I had to get beyond it. I had to, in order to move forward and heal myself, I had to let go of these fears and just not let them take hold of me. And so I looked at death right in the eye, right? And I realized that it is, you know, we are about our relationships, right? I was being stretched too thin. Like I was, I was trying to keep my marriage together and then it fell apart. I was trying to do this huge commute and I couldn't do it. I was trying to do all these dangerous experiments and I did do them, but there was, you know, maybe it was too much, but the fact of the matter is I was faced with this very deadly disease. And so I learned from the healing process that I was meant to heal. I learned from my doctors. I there's so many wise people out there who are able to know this stuff. I think, you know, just by their sheer wit, their sheer intelligence, their sheer compassion, or maybe where they came from before this life. But I learned from them that you know, we are meant to heal. And that, you know, it really takes quite a bit to kill us. And then, but also, if I do die, that's okay too, right? That I will carry on, or, you know, my spirit will carry on, what I've done will carry on, my daughters will carry on, life will carry on, and that my life was worth living. And you know, that there is something after, you know, there's some other experience beyond this. And so everything is going to be okay. And once I got to that point that all is going to be okay, I was okay. I was fine. And I was able to fight it. I was able to recover from it. I understood, you know, the power of connection, the power of relationships. I really built my relationships. We formed a group of women that were going through chemo, and I'm very tight with them to this very day. I think it's been 9 years now. We're very interdependent. Mm-hmm. But there are tipping points, right? And in ecosystems, that's true too. Like there's only so much damage a body can take, obviously, or an ecosystem, like we do die, and ecosystems do unravel. And I think in terms of the balance in our planet, we don't want our ecosystems to get to the point of collapse. We don't want it to be the point of where we're, you know, we're having to resuscitate our environment. I mean, we're kind of, you know, encroaching on that, but you know, we know enough to pull back, that we need to be more, you know, healing, more reciprocal with our environment, not just exploitive, but to be productive with it, to work with it, to fulfill our obligations to care for it. And then the earth is wired, it's evolved to heal with proper care. But with exploitation, then, you know, it's at risk. So mm-hmm. anyway, it's the same in our bodies. It's the same in our ecosystems.
I have what might be a strange question, but you know, you're talking about like, we're talking like every sort of every question we're talking about a value shift, right? We're talking about one system to another. And I was wondering, you know, the values that your whole work has been in service of, and the values that I think many of us here in this event tonight are hoping to be more in service of in our own lives. Mm-hmm. These values are very gendered as female, right? Like the mm-hmm. nurturance, humility, interdependence, which is something that I feel like, you know, it has been a primary thing on my mind, how to embrace that at every level of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder, you know, because there's this moment in the book where you lash out at your brother, because mm-hmm. you know, you're at a bar, it's been a long day, and he's mm-hmm. he's talking about, you know, it's like, I think he's a rancher, right? And he's reducing the role. He sort of says something about how, you know, how cows, like female cows, their job is just to take care of the calves, and, you know, effectively implying the same about women, that mm-hmm. our job is to nurture and, you know, just like stay in this little zone. And it makes you really angry, as it would have made me angry if my brother had said that to me. And yet, like, it's hard to fight the fact that these are feminized ideas, right? That nurturance and interdependence. And I wonder if you have, except, you know, I wonder what your relationship is to the fact that these attributes, which should not be gendered really, are, we identify these values so strongly with women, protection mm-hmm. and care and, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, one thing is that we can't be black and white about this stuff, right? Yeah. Like it's shades of gray all the way through. Mm-hmm. And we do tend to get into our camps. And I think that the first thing we do is not do that. And I've certainly been there, and it's easy to do that. And it's harder to be in the middle and understand both sides, all sides. And so I think that one thing about, you know, in my field and in many, many fields that where women were, you know, new to the field, like, you know, we did have, there has been long periods in history where women have been like at home and looking after the kids and not being in the working world or not in that, you know, the male working world. And the consequence, so in my field, I can speak to that the most effectively, is that, you know, all the research, for example, on how forests are structured has been done through men have done it because they were the ones that had those jobs and they had the, you know, the great privilege of getting to do that research, and they looked at it through their eyes. But it didn't give us a whole view, because there are many, many ways to look at these forests. And when we get trapped into one way of viewing things, we make a lot of mistakes because it is such a complex place where we're all, you know, all ways of looking at are important: female, male, Aboriginal, Western, it's all Eastern, it's all important. And then we get a fuller picture. And so I think that where are we here? So I think that, you know, as women move into these fields, and it is a tough row to hoe, because there's a lot of gendered bias. There still is. It's getting better. And the more women that get into engineering and science and forestry and, you know, the better, the more fuller picture we'll have of how these systems work. Including their collaborative networks mm-hmm. and their nurturing ability. And it's essential that we do that. It's essential that women get into these jobs, do the work, pave the way for more women to do the work, so that we all understand these systems better, so that we treat them better, more holistically. And we're going to have, you know, we all have to work together to make this happen. Like, even for me, I'm a fully tenured professor at UBC. I've been there for 20 years almost, and I still get a lot of hits, right? Like, it's not that it's on purpose, but it's just there. It's just this sort of, you know, undercurrent. And so the women and the men need to band together and say, we got to do a better job of this. We got to allow women to bring their full selves to the table, to ask their full questions and ask and answer them with their research, and empower their graduate students to do the good work, because we'll all benefit from that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's, yeah, there's this sense, kind of this through line through the book, where people are sort of looking at you and the ideas that you're, you know, that you're espousing, as if it's like, oh, look at this woman talking about like this like hippie, like, you know, let's have all the plants together. You know, there's this idea that, again, it's this sort of like almost emotional proposition, when in fact it's not, when in fact, you know, in like a more equal and just world and society, like these values would not be gendered, that care would be shared and, you know, distributed, right? Okay, we're gonna go to audience questions in just a second, but, you know, a couple more things, you know, so you were talking about, I mean, when you were just talking about death a few minutes ago, you were talking about like this period where you are fighting breast cancer. It coincides with a research period where you're trying to understand mm-hmm. what you call the sort of final question about the mother trees. What do they do when their lives are ending? Mm-hmm. Do they pass on their resources and sort of one last push of nurturing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What did you find? And also, I wondered, you know, there is this parallel throughout much of the book of, you know, the things that you're seeing with yourself and your daughters, like there is some sort of analog in what you're seeing in your work. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, to what extent was your experience of motherhood shaped by your research?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or vice versa, right? Your research shaped by your experience of motherhood.
Yeah, no, really great questions again. Like, you know, I've published over 200 journal articles in scientific peer-reviewed journals, which is peer review is the benchmark, right? That's how science moves forward. But a lot of the stuff never gets read. And so I wanted people to understand it, that, you know, first to get the work out, but also that science is it's a journey. Like, it's a very human story. You know, the questions that I asked those questions because I grew up in the forest. I saw how it worked. And then I saw how we were making, you know, these mistakes. And so as I went along, you know, my life informed all the questions that I asked. And that's a really important story, I think, when people are suspicious of science, or they think that it's, you know, that I don't understand, so I don't trust it. You know, I wanted to dispel that, because science comes from us. It's about how we make sense of our world. It's how we come to understand how the world works, and then we can, you know, have agency in how it moves forward. And I wanted people to know that it's just a human thing from our hearts, and it's a passion, and it's full of compassion, and it's and that our lives, you know, are informed by our science, and science informs our lives. And I can't emphasize enough how important it is to embrace this, that, you know, this is really meaningful work, and each person's experience comes to the table, and in a really meaningful way. I don't think anybody would have asked the questions that I asked if I hadn't done it the way I did it, right? That I was a mom, that I got breast cancer, that I was trying to figure out, what do I do if I die and my kids are only 10 years old? And yeah. And that was why I asked the question of, what happens when a mom is dying, or a mother tree is dying in the forest? Mm-hmm. What about the seedlings around her? And so I did this experiment with my graduate students where we stressed a mother tree to the point of dying, and then followed her energy, basically carbon, using carbon isotopic tracers. And we trace carbon 13 as it moved through, you know, from photosynthesis to the roots, through the mycorrhizal network, and actually into the seedlings, that especially the ones that were the kin seedlings, this is her own kin. And more energy went as she passed on. And so this was a profound discovery, that not only was, you know, was the energy not just evaporating into the general atmosphere, it was being directed, and it was being directed direct, you know, into her own kin, into her genes, which is very Darwinian, right? That is a survival of the fittest concept. But here it was, right? That these ecosystems are really designed, you know, as I say, to heal mm-hmm. through multiple generations, not just one mother tree dying. It's actually sending on resilience to the next generations, her children as well. So anyway, it's all, you know, bringing ourselves to our work is really, really important, our full selves to our work.
It's wonderful to hear that from you. I'll say just the last thing before we go to audience questions. You recommend towards the end, you know, there are a lot of people asking, like, what should we do in the chat, you know, and the question of what we, it's, you know, like we could talk about that for an hour, but there is one among the things that you suggest at the end or the epilogue of the memoir, you suggest that people start as like a very first starting point that people mm-hmm. connect with a plant that they can call their own. And it sounds so simple, but I was realizing reading that, that that actually was the beginning. You know, that was like a recent, that was maybe 4 years ago for me that I got my first houseplant and it legitimately changed. Mm-hmm. You know, it has been a slow, it has been that finding a plant that I could connect with. And yeah. I really appreciated that simple tip.
Yeah, no, it's really important. It's very fundamental. It's being connected, and you can do that. Just go sit with a plant, go sit with a tree. And before you know it, you're going to be part of that tree. You'll be looking after it. It'll be your caring circle, right? it connects you to nature really profoundly.
Let me ask you, so a question from the audience, how has your research affected current forestry practices, and what change in practices do you see that give you hope for the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I've always said that over all my decades of research that forestry practice hadn't changed, hardly at all. We're still, the vast majority of cutting in the north in Canada and in the US is clear cutting. Now you're seeing more trees left in these cuts, but they're, you know, begrudgingly left. So usually they're the smallest trees, the ones that are the least valuable. And then there's still herbicide spraying, right? There's still getting rid of these native plants. That still goes on. However, there is a shift, right? Up where I live in British Columbia, there's been enormous protests lately against the last remaining really iconic valley bottom old growth forests. We've only got 3% left. And so people are standing up and saying, hey, what about my future? You know, this is, I need clean water and I need, you know, a carbon neutral environment for me too. And I, you know, and we need these creatures. And so there's a shift happening, and now is the time to get in there and really push hard to make this shift really happening. And one of the things I can note as a concrete example is that I was asked to participate in this industry talk this last week. And they're saying, the pressure has been so great from the public that we've got to move away from clear cutting to partial cutting. And they want to leave 40 to 60% of the forest intact after so they only take out about half or less than half. That is an enormous shift. And that isn't because of the research. The research is there to inform how to do that. That push came from the public, right? The public complaining that these systems are not sustainable. What we're doing to these forests is not working for us. And so then government and industry changed. And so it's got to be push, push, push until there's a change. And the push has to be relentless. And then the science, you know, yes, then the science is there. How do we do this?
Another question from the audience. A question from somebody who wants to know, you know, much of what you bring up in your work about interdependence is, as you acknowledge, rooted in Indigenous teachings and ways of life and tradition. Were there any specific specific teachings or specific Aboriginal and Indigenous nations knowledge that you specifically drew from?
Yeah, well, there's so much. And of course, Western science is kind of, as one Haltsik woman said, is Western science is the little sister to Indigenous science, right? We're just learning in Western science. We know so little. And this Indigenous knowledge has been, you know, building for thousands and thousands of years. So thousands and thousands of years of observation and experimentation. Okay, so of what will work. And for example, the salmon runs, right? They were very sensitive to the variability in the salmon runs and passively fishing and always throwing the mothers back to spawn so they could have big mothers in the future and really strong populations. That was through observation. And it was also through care, right? And carrying out obligations to the salmon as though they were their, you know, their sisters and their brothers, and caring for them like their families. And it worked, right? The populations were healthy and strong. And I think that, you know, one of the biggest lessons for me as I was doing my work and struggling with the forest industry and trying to get them to acknowledge that the forest is a connected place. And then I was fortunate to work with a Tsimshian woman who was my postdoc at the time, who was a salmon fishery scientist. And she demonstrated to me how this worked. And she said, the way our worldview is that we were all connected. That we are all related, whether you're the wolf or the salmon, the bear, the person, we're all related. We're all in this together. We need to work with each other, and it's about our relationships, and we need to nurture those relationships, honor them, and reciprocate, you know, with our brothers and sisters, look after them and they'll look after us. And I think that for me, that was like, yes, that's what I'd been trying to struggling with in my own Western narrow view of science, and trying to fight this industry that was so steeped in this exploitation model that, you know, that when she said those things, I was just like, manna from heaven, thank goodness, this makes sense. And, you know, so that was profound. And then more and more, as I learn about concentric, you know, the concentric nature of indigenous tribes and nations, you know, that they're, you know, the kinship is so important among just not just our families, but our communities and our forests and our salmon. And yeah, each step has been really profoundly important.
There's a great question in the audience chat about, you know, the fact that many people don't have the privilege of being close to nature, right? Like that don't have not grown up with the ability to generate a connection to nature for whatever reason. The question is sort of like, how do we communicate the value of caring for and protecting ourselves in these places? And I wonder if you have an answer for that. But for me, what you just said, I think one of the ways I've been trying to think through this myself is it is the value system of kinship. It is a value system that is against hierarchy and mm-hmm. towards equality. I mean, it's all one and the same. It's like some mm-hmm. working towards that value system, even outside of nature, mm-hmm. is ultimately something that will benefit nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you've hit it on right on. Like, I think most people have some access to a plant or a bug or an ant or a worm. It doesn't really matter what that creature is. It can even be your own family, if anything else, or your friends, right? So think of how your relationships work with your family, for example, or your friends. If you're always taking, the friendship collapses, right? It's got to be reciprocal. And to be a healthy relationship, it's a give and take thing. Now extend that idea. Think of yourself as an eagle that's flying out and seeing the world as a broader and broader place. And your family also includes the forests and the rivers and the oceans and the salmon. Now those relationships with them are the same. We've got to treat them the same as we would with our friends and our family. It's reciprocal. It's we look after each other. We have each other's back. And so I think everybody knows that. Right. Otherwise, you know, you don't last long because we are about our relationships, and just extend that to a broader circle, that your circle is not just you. It's not just your family. It's not just your community. It's all of it. Right. Mm-hmm. So the same principles apply.
I'm going to ask you this question, and then please keep talking while I let my dog in my bedroom, because she is, I can hear her growling at me. A question from the audience: how does one identify a mother tree in a forest, and is it possible for a non-ecologist to find one?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, for sure. So mother trees are just the biggest trees in the forest. They're, you know, pretty much, you know, every forest has structure, physical structure, where there's smaller trees and bigger trees. And just, you know, trees get a head start because maybe their species is, you know, fast growing, or the seed landed on a really productive spot, or a wet, you know, a nice microsite. Or genetically they're, you know, are fortunate to be, you know, genetically bigger or, you know, faster growing. So those are the trees that become the mother trees. They just are that, bigger stature tree in the forest. You can go into any forest, any park, and you'll see these trees. You can pick them out. They usually have bigger diameters or bigger girth, and height is correlated with girth, and correlated with girth is the crown. The crown is the leaf area, and that's where the photosynthesis happens. That's where the energy of the light is converted to chemical energy, and that's what drives, you know, the role of the mother tree in providing energy to the whole system. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. Like I feel like I reread the Overstory this past year and was like just like kind of stoned and like, wow, trees are literally eating sunlight and water. And I felt like a, you know, like small child learning it for the first time. I'm gonna end with a question that might seem silly, but I also really wanna know. Someone from the audience asked, for both of us, what are your favorite trees and why? I will say that I have an aspen in my backyard. I have four aspens.
And beautiful.
I have come to really appreciate the particular sound that aspens make. I learned that they spring up first because they can do well with like lots of sunlight and not much else. And they have these little crowns of loud little leaves and these spare trunks, and I really like them.
Yeah, they are absolutely beautiful. I agree. And they're clonal, which means that they can cover huge areas and be one individual that's got many stems that are clonal.
That's
they're
right.
absolutely
they're like
stunning.
Jellyfish, where you don't know how to classify the group, whether it's one or the it's wild.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think my favorite tree. Well, I have lots of favorites, so it's hard. Yeah, it's like saying what's your favorite kid. Like you can't do it. But one of
who's
ones.
Your favorite kid? Just kidding.
Both of them, really. Yeah. Anyway, I love backpacking, and I spent a lot of time in the subalpine and the alpine, and the subalpine forests around here in Canada, where I live. There's a lot of subalpine fir, and they grow in clusters where you have, you know, the center parent trees, and then as they protect the, you know, the soil and the seedlings grow up around them. And so it really does look like, you know, this little family in the forest, these islands of trees, and they provide shelter for hikers too. So I think that I have a lot of fond memories of hiking among these trees and even hiding in them in big snowstorms. So I think they're one of my favorites.
That's so cool. God, trees are cool, you know?
Yeah, they are.
Okay, well, it has been so lovely to speak to you.
Likewise.
Such a pleasure.
Likewise.
And our hour's up, and thank you to Aloud, to the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Public Library, and to the like over 300 people that came and hung out. Thank you for joining us for thinking about these things with us. And I hope we all go out and take care of, you know, our little trees, the people around us in whatever way we can.
Thank you, Gia, and thank you for everybody for listening.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.